Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome to the program. Today, we're going to explore autism, a link with vaccines and mercury in the first part of our show. Then we're going to look at Alzheimer's, a link with dental amalgams and mercury. Both shows have something in common, mercury. And yet we're led to believe that mercury is not a problem, that it's not evaporating out into the mouth and getting into the central nervous system or brain. What is it we're not being told that could be affecting virtually everyone in this audience? We'll go there in a few moments. First, those of you who have been making your own little health shake each morning, for instance, taking some fresh tomatoes and putting in some cayenne pepper and a little bit of garlic and onion, so you make a kind of a cold gazpacho, good for you because you're flooding the body with about 10 to 20 milligrams of a lycopene, L-Y-C-O-P-E-N-E. Lycopene is good because, as all the flavonoids, and it's in the flavonoid family, it has strong antioxidant properties. In fact, it's right up there with vitamin C and vitamin E. Most people, regrettably, only get enough lycopene that might be on the tomato sauce on a pizza, which is about nothing. And they don't eat their tomatoes. But what we have to understand is if we take 2 to 3 tomatoes a day, or what would be equivalent to 1 8-ounce glass of tomato juice a day, and we can make it ourselves, which is the best way. That way we can get organic tomatoes. It still has this enzyme and live food energy intact. Or under the worst case scenario, you'll still get your lycopene, but it won't be from organic tomatoes, and the enzymes won't be there because it will have been pasteurized and processed to be in a jar of tomato juice. But if you get it, you're going to protect yourself against certain types of cancer. You'll block the LDL cholesterol, that's the bad cholesterol that can be a partial cause of atherosclerosis. You're going to protect against free radicals, the primary reason that we age prematurely. And it is easy to absorb by the body. So make sure that you're getting your lycopene each day. And for senior citizens who are on a restricted budget, and this is so important because the more free radicals you're able to neutralize, the greater your health benefits will be. For those of you who are still drinking coffee because you have been led to believe that it's actually good for you and that it will stimulate a higher blood flow, a higher volume of blood, and that's why people take it to overcome a headache. That's true, but it also is the number one cause of headaches in the United States. So for all the people who are addicted to any form of coffee, it's not a good scenario. What we find is that there's a study done earlier this year that found that unfiltered coffee raises the bad LDL cholesterol. The very thing I just mentioned that lycopene helps you lower, coffee raises it. That's bad. That can contribute to a potential heart disease and stroke. The culprit was thought to be the diterpenes. These are chemicals that are removed from the filtered coffee. A new study at the Agricultural University in Wageningen, the Netherlands, has delivered another blow to coffee lovers, finding that even filtered coffee is bad for blood vessels. The malefactor this time, homocysteine. Now, most people would have thought homocysteine. Well, doesn't that come when you're deficient in vitamin B12, B6, and folic acid? Yes, it does. But we now know that there is a link between elevated homocysteine and heart disease and stroke. And many are beginning to think that high blood homocysteine levels are as dangerous as high blood levels of bad cholesterol. In a two-part study, adults that drank a liter of unfiltered coffee each day for 2 weeks, a control group of 34 drank tea, water, or milk, or broth over the same period. Blood tests found that the coffee drinkers had substantially increased homocysteine levels, which showed that something that we never knew before. No one knew that coffee by itself would elevate homocysteine levels. So, another reason not to drink your caffeine. This comes from information from Discovery. The foods today are being created by manufacturers, not to feed us our nutrients, but rather to be called functional foods. Functional foods are vehicles for allowing us to have the benefit of so-called medicines. That means that vaccines, chemotherapy agents, and various forms of, let's say, viruses or bacteria that have been genetically altered can now be given directly to us through this enormous, what they see, growing market of functional foods. They're now even growing a vaccine on corn, so that when you eat your corn, you will be inoculated against AIDS. Now, will they ever end up coming out with such a vaccine? Possibly, but it certainly won't have anything to do with AIDS. But we're subsidizing all that. And what about if you didn't want to be inoculated against AIDS? What if you didn't want the vaccine? Wouldn't matter. Unless you ate specific organic corn, if you ate any corn in any form, or even glucose, which is the most common sweetener used in the United States, you'd be getting that vaccine. And I'm sure you would ask yourself, well, what if you had corn on a daily basis? Then you're getting vaccinated on a daily basis. Well, isn't there a danger of having even too much? Let's just say, for argument's sake, that they found that this vaccine was beneficial, necessary, and could indeed help inoculate you against AIDS. Well, you wouldn't go in every single day to get a vaccine from your doctor. You would end up with an excessive vaccine issue. But why wouldn't it be true if you were eating a food that had the vaccine in it? Of course, that is also the case. But no one seems to have calculated that into their equation, which is one of the reasons that functional foods are not the foods that I would recommend. By the way, one of the major cities in California voted down fluoride yesterday in a referendum. And the people who sponsored that came to me about 7 months ago, and I told them to go to my webpage, GaryNall.com, and I had an always updated information on fluoride, plus a major article that could be used by activists to challenge fluoridation. And once again, part of that was not just all the mutagenic and carcinogenic and immune suppressive activity of even one part per million, the amount you'd find in a glass of water fluoride, but it's a medication as it's currently applied. And where it's never been shown to prevent dental caries, and the study that claimed that it did was shown to be defective and had no such positive association, you're immunizing an entire population. So every time you take a glass of water or cook in that water, you're in effect taking a medication. Well, do we have a right as individuals not to accept a collective mandated what's good for one is good for all medication? And the answer is yes, we do. But in this case, you have to either buy bottled water, filter your water, or you have to pass a referendum to defeat it. And they did exactly that. So good for them out in California in that city. I just got word when I was doing my Roy of Hollywood show this morning on them defeating that, and they used the information from the webpage. By the way, I'm putting up an enormous amount of new information on genetic engineering. I'm doing a documentary on genetic engineering right now, and we'll be filming it over the next 3 to 4 months. Hopefully, it'll be ready for viewing sometime about 6-7 months from now. And anyone who wants to know why you would oppose genetic engineering, both in humans and in food, you can go to GaryNall.com and you'll get all the latest information. Let's now go to our guest, Lynn Redwood. Lynn is the president of Safe Minds, a nonprofit organization whose goal is the prevention of mercury-induced neurological disorders. She's a registered nurse and a nurse practitioner from Atlanta, Georgia. She's also a member of the Board of Health of Fayette County, Georgia, and she's the parent of a 6-year-old son who was diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder, a form of autism. Her son was also found to be suffering from mercury neurotoxicity. In July of this year, Lynn testified before the Government Reform Committee concerning the issue of utilizing mercury in childhood vaccines. Nice to have you with us today, Lynn.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk about thimerosal, what it is and why it's used in infant vaccines.
Thimerosal is a preservative, and it was first manufactured back in the 1930s. and it was utilized at that time in vaccines, in the DPT vaccine. The purpose for this preservative is to prevent bacterial contamination in multi-dose vials of vaccine. And this would be in the case where the nurse might introduce a dirty needle into the vaccine container, and sometimes bacteria would grow in the vaccine and contaminate it. The problem with thimerosal is that it contains 49.6% ethyl mercury by weight. This product, like I said, has been used since the 1930s. And what's very interesting, Gary, is that it was in the early 1940s, 1943, that Dr. Kanner first described a new unique disorder called autism. What's happened over the past decade is the incidence of autism has just dramatically increased, and that increase has paralleled the increased utilization of vaccines and the addition of vaccines to the early vaccine schedule.
How long has this thimerosal been used in vaccines, and if it's been used since the 1930s, why are we just now seeing problems with its use?
Oh, what happened, Gary, back in the 1930s when this was first utilized, there was only one vaccine, DPT.
I'm going to ask you to speak up a little bit. You're speaking too softly.
There was only one vaccine, the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, that utilized the thimerosal. And at that time, only children that were of upper socioeconomic class were receiving vaccines. In the 1970s, through government-mandated programs and federal sponsoring, vaccines were more widely utilized, and again, we saw a significant increase in the incidence of autism. At that time in the 1970s, there were 2 to 4 children per 10,000 children with autism. Now, in the 1990s, something changed significantly with our vaccine program. In the late 1980, there was an addition of a vaccine called Haemophilus influenza B. And that vaccine was given at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, and it contained thimerosal. There was also the addition of hepatitis B vaccine that was given at birth and again in the first 6 months of life. The addition of those 2 vaccines to the early vaccine schedule essentially tripled an infant's exposure to mercury. It's at the same time in the early 1990s that we have just seen this tremendous increase in children diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorders and autism. The incidence, according to CDC, just published this past year from data from Brick Township, was 1 in every 150 children are suffering with some form of autism disorders, whether that's Asperger's or full-blown autism or pervasive developmental disorders. And what I found personally with my son is that all of the early vaccines that he had received had contained this mercury preservative, thimerosal. Just to give you an example, Gary, at 2 months of age, my son received 62.5 micrograms of ethyl mercury in 3 separate vaccines, his DPT, HIB, and hepatitis B. His allowable exposure for that day was only 0.5 micrograms of mercury, according to EPA. He had received 125 times his allowable exposure to mercury from his infant vaccines at 2 months of age. This occurred again at 4 months of age, at 6 months of age. And as I mentioned, at 5 years of age, he was found to have very high levels of mercury, and this was from sampling from baby hair that I sent off for analysis. The reason this information came out is that the FDA Modernization Act required the FDA to go back and determine the cumulative exposure to mercury in vaccines. Well, this data was published in July of 1999, and the report reads that if infants were to have received multiple vaccines containing thimerosal, they would have exceeded federal safety guidelines for safe mercury exposure. Now, not all vaccines have thimerosal. There are many different manufacturers of vaccines. So if a parent were to want to research whether or not their child had received these vaccines, they would need to go back to the pediatrician and determine who the manufacturer was of the vaccines that their child had received. Not all of the vaccines had this mercury. But infants that did receive multiple doses of thimerosal preserved vaccines did exceed the federal safety guidelines for safe mercury exposure.
I need you to speak up. Project.
Okay, I'm sorry. I will try to speak louder.
All right. What is being done to stop this?
Well, when the FDA announced in July of 1999 that certain vaccines contain thimerosal, they also called for the immediate reduction and elimination of thimerosal from vaccines. Some of the vaccine manufacturers have responded fairly rapidly with new products where they remove the thimerosal. Others have not. One of our big concerns is that these vaccines are still available. They're still out on the market, and that they should not be given routinely to infants. In June of this year, the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices went back and looked at their vaccine safety data link information. And this information comes from a number of large HMOs out in California, where all of the medical records are electronic. They have over 400,000 children enrolled in this database. And they were able to put in the vaccines that contain thimerosal along with different diagnostic codes. And when they did this, they found that there was a statistically significant association between exposure to thimerosal-containing vaccines at 6 months of age with attention deficit disorder. They also found statistically significant associations between thimerosal exposure at 1, 3, and 6 months of age with speech and language delays and neurodevelopmental delays in general. They are currently looking into further research into this area, but I think this is a big concern, and that all parents should request from their pediatricians that their children receive only vaccines that are not preserved with the thimerosal.
If people want more information, how can they get this from you?
There's a number of different websites that are available. I would say the first place to go to find out specifically about mercury and efforts to have it reduced in infant vaccines would be the Safe Minds organization. We have information available at our website, www.safeminds.org. I would also encourage every parent of a newborn infant or a young child to be an informed consumer for their vaccines. We research as parents the safest car to drive, the best car seat. We need to do the same thing for vaccines. I certainly wish that I had a good site to go to find out what type of vaccines are available, what the potential risks are, what the benefits are of those vaccines, would be www.909shot.com. That's the National Vaccine Information Center. And parents, again, need to be informed consumers for their children. They need to look at their child's risk and determine whether or not they should receive that vaccine. Another good website, if you would like specific information about autism, would be www.autism.com/ARI. That's the Autism Research Institute. There's also a wealth of information about the concern for mercury in medicine and in vaccines specifically through the government reform website, and that address is www.house.gov/reform. And then when you get to that website, you can click on hearings, and there was a hearing in July on mercury medicine, and you can read the individual testimonies concerning physicians who were involved, along with the response from our federal agencies like FDA and CDC.
Well, we appreciate you being on, Lynn. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. That was Lynn Redwood. She's very concerned, and her group's doing a lot of good work to inform parents. Let me work out the rest of this about 10 minutes here by giving you some additional insights. This comes from Maria Karlshamer. She is a journalist in Sweden. She says, the truth is, how common are vaccine injuries in Sweden? No one knows. The vaccine manufacturers, who stand to lose quite a lot of money, don't want anyone to even discuss it. And so far they have succeeded, with the help of the Swedish government. When my youngest son got encephalitis after his vaccination for measles, mumps, and rubella, there wasn't much time to sit down and mourn. I decided to start immediately and do everything in my power to get him well again. To be able to do this, I had to find out what happened when he got sick. But it turned out getting the information wasn't easy. Working as an investigative journalist, I'm used to searching for information, browsing incomprehensible documents in search of important truths. Nevertheless, this specific task soon turned beyond compare. In Sweden, we are normally very good at keeping papers in order. We measure and get figures on literally everything in our efforts to build a good society. Accurate statistics have become something typically Swedish. So I was more than surprised when I understood it wasn't just hard to get proper figures in Sweden concerning vaccine damage, it was impossible. But according to the official figures, there are no side effects of any serious kind at all. But today, the day after the revealing TV show on Channel 4, we now know at least 20 parents already have received payments because of vaccine damage to their kids. But is it all happening behind closed doors? To get the money, the parents have to sign a paper that they will not reveal the truth and go to court? This is the mafia's way of doing business, and a disgrace for our country, Sweden. One of the consequences, of course, is there are no serious side effects officially registered, and the parents trying to report their suspicions are simply denied a proper investigation. Officially, it has never happened. So then it has to be very unlikely that it would happen at all. And then new innocent parents bring their kids in to be vaccinated, since there are no known risks. And very few of the parents whose children are actually injured suspect a connection between their children's problems and the vaccination. The connection seems so utterly unlikely, and we trust the authorities. Through this vaccine industry, with the help of the Swedish government, has been able to silence the health scandal that may turn out to be gigantic in proportions. When grown-ups get encephalitis, the time to recover is long and difficult. When children get brain inflammation, it is far more serious. Many cases of autism are quite probably simply the chronic continuation of the acute inflammation and damage of the brain. The damage to the brain becomes permanent. And since they happen at a crucial time in the development of this damage, they can itself lead to a worsening of several symptoms. Today, we know quite a lot about how different vaccines can result in brain inflammation or encephalitis, with a further development to autism. It makes even more interesting to investigate possible connections between different vaccines and possible increases. In the United States, such studies have been made, and what was found was frightening. The autism incidence increased 900% in just the 1990s, and the increase doesn't slow down. And it doesn't just grow, it's increasing by leaps and bounds. The National Institutes of Health has now admitted that the increase cannot be explained through better diagnostic tools or better statistics. The increase is an epidemic and so far impossible to explain. There is scientific research confirming that for many cases of brain inflammation leading to serious neurological damage, there's about 100 cases of milder cases of brain damage due to this kind of encephalitis. This does not lead to permanent damage or autism, but problems like allergies, infectious susceptibility, hyperactivity, and difficulties in learning. We are no longer talking about a small number of children with severe disorders, but a large group with mild brain damage that will be discovered in schools, if at all. In the United States, there are statistics concerning the number of children getting different diagnoses concerning the brain. This explains why the dramatic rise in autism incidence was discovered. But when I give the Swedish equivalent of the National Institutes of Health a call, they tell me there are no national or regional figures at all. Maybe the hospitals know more, the nice lady tells me. I call them, but they don't know either. Nowhere has anyone actually connected the number of formal diagnosis of any form of brain disorder, or autism in particular, to vaccinations. But an opinion poll is still not a proper election, even though the people believe that there is an association. So That's just from Maria Karlsmeier, an investigative journalist in Sweden. So the dilemma here is, where do we get the truth? And the answer is, you have to dig for it. Keep in mind, the very same people who said there's no association between autism and vaccines is the same agencies who said there's no association between neurological activity or any physical symptomology and Gulfmore syndrome. It took 10 years and 200,000 service personnel to suffer terrible consequences to acknowledge that. How much longer do we have to realize that compulsory vaccination for children is not only an ill-thought public health measure, it causes the very diseases it's claiming to prevent. Now, more specific on autism, the brain and the immune system, in the year 2000, the controversial hypothesis that autism is somehow linked with vaccination has set the stage for a long overdue examination of the interaction between the brain and the immune system and the evidence for both disease and vaccine-induced immune and brain dysfunction, which has been documented in the medical literature for more than 200 years. I've had on this program Dr. Bernard Rimland, and clear back in the 1960s, he was able to show that these damages of autism were biological, not psychological in cause. In fact, we have been led to believe that it's all psychological. Not true. Go to the Journal of Autism and Childhood Schizophrenia, 1973. An article by Dr. DeMeyer said, quote, the findings study in conjunction with other investigations support the biological cause theory of autism. The authors noted that a high number of autistic children have gross EEG abnormalities and are neurologically handicapped with learning and behavioral disorders that range from mild to severe mental retardation. They concluded the, quote, viral disease during or after gestation, birth trauma, malnutrition, oxygen lack, or generally any of the events known to damage the brain may be the cause of autistic syndrome, unquote. Well, what that also means is that you're looking at viruses, live viruses, and vaccines, bacteria in vaccines, mercury in vaccines. My guest just now was just talking about the problems of mercury because look at just what is in not just vaccine, but in other medications. You have thimerosal, which is a mercury product, and in her case, her child was getting 125 times, not percent, times, what the child should have received for a safe level. Now, how many vaccines did the child get? 33 vaccines. So with each assault against the immune system, you bring in a body burden. Well, it's one thing to say, all right, we made a mistake, we gave your child 100 times more mercury than the safe level. But no problem, it was washed out of the system in 24 hours. Not true. Mercury can lodge in the brain permanently. It can lodge in nervous tissue. It can take a lifetime to get the mercury out of your system unless you know how to properly chelate it out. And there's two types of chelation therapy. An EDTA, ethylene diamine tetracyclic acid, will not do it. It will get heavy metals like lead out, but it won't get mercury. It takes a separate issue. My brother is probably one of the world's leading authorities right now on chelation therapy of lead and mercury in children. That's what he's been working on, trying to get lead out of gasoline, clean up the air, and at the same time show that there are studies that can show the degree of damage due to these. And it is difficult to get these out of the system. So this doesn't pass. So every time you get an exposure to mercury, every time you get a silver filling put in your mouth, you get a medication that has thimerosal in it, you get a vaccine, it adds to the body burden. And then one day you wake up and, gee whiz, you have hepatitis, or you have herpes, or you have cancer, and you think, how do you get that? You'll never think about the vaccines. But look again, because you can find almost all the associated diseases today with the immune system. Vaccines can play a role. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief station ID break. We'll come back and continue on with our discussion. Please stay with us.
And And good afternoon once again. It is 29 degrees in New York City at 12:31. You are tuned to listener-sponsored commercial-free community radio, WBAI, in New York at 99.5 FM. We're on the World Wide Web, and you can connect with us thanks to porus.com, P-O-R-U-S. And you might want to click on WBAI.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, and Armand will be looking at loneliness today. That's at 1 o'clock. At 2 p.m., Stealing the Deed, a four-part public affairs series, and you want to stay tuned for that. Talk back with Eutrice Lead from 3 to 5 p.m. But right now, we return to Natural Living with Gary Noll.
I'd like to welcome everyone who's just coming across the dial. I'm Gary Noll. Our program today, we're examining the effects of mercury. Just now we talked about mercury and vaccines. But that's not where most people would identify mercury. They would identify it possibly with their silver fillings. Now, what role does this have? Well, it depends upon who you speak with. If you speak with any of the quackbusters, people who have self-appointed themselves as guardians of the gates of orthodox concept, there is no such thing as a bad mercury filling effect upon the body. In fact, they have made it their mission to insist that any dentist who removes mercury fillings from your mouth is practicing bad dentistry and should have their license revoked, and indeed dentists have. So is there a danger? What is the danger? What's the science behind it? We've invited Dr. Boyd Haley, H-A-L-E-Y, professor and chair of the Department of Chemistry, University of Kentucky. He holds a PhD in chemistry and biochemistry from Washington State University, including postdoctoral training in physiology from Yale University Medical School. Welcome to our program, Dr. Haley.
Thank you.
Dr. Haley's research has shown that exposure of normal human brain tissue to mercury causes inhibition of the same enzymes that have been demonstrated to be inhibited in the Alzheimer's disease brain. His investigation into childhood vaccinations has suggested a cause of various autism disorders, and some vaccines tested contained an organic mercury compound called thimerosal that we just discussed, which is found to be even more toxic than mercury. And unknown to most people, however, is that vaccines can also contain other highly toxic additives, such as aluminum chloride and formaldehyde. And the combination of mercury, aluminum chloride, and formaldehyde can significantly increase the toxicity of the vaccine mixture. Yet, is the average person made aware of this? Are they given the type of informed consent that could allow them to say, yes, I accept the risks, or no, I think that is excessive? No, unfortunately, we're not. We're just told it's compulsory, you have to take it, and you can't get your kid into school. Dr. Haley, where do you think the major exposure to mercury comes from, and how do you know this?
Well, you know, I think the major exposure to, say, most American people would come from their dental amalgams, and the reason I believe this is that, you know, there's several things. You just don't depend upon one item. If you do a mercury challenge test on, you know, where you put in a chelator that would bind the mercury in the body and cause it to be excreted in the urine, this was done by Dr. Val Lapotian at Arizona University, or the University of Arizona, the mercury, the higher your amalgams, the higher content of amalgams you have, the more mercury you have in your body at that on this testing. The second thing is, you know, go to the bottom line. You can make an amalgam outside of the mouth. You can have this amalgam sitting in a beaker, and you can take what is a mercury vapor sniffer, or you can drop the amalgam in water, and you can test the amount of mercury in the water by using atomic absorption spectrophotometry. And in both these things tell you that mercury comes out at a very significant rate. If you place that amalgam in a soft Kleenex tissue and hold it in front of an amalgam mercury vapor sniffer, and you'll get a reading, a maximum amount of mercury coming off. If you gently rub that amalgam with a soft Kleenex and just rub it in your hands, like you know, much less pressure than you would put on if you were chewing gum, you can cause the meter to peg. In other words, it will go off scale on many cases. So there's no doubt that mercury, you know, comes out of dental amalgams without any pressure put on them or any heat. But if you do put pressure, heat, or abrasion on them, it comes out, you know, at a dramatically elevated area. And I would also point out that measuring the intraoral mercury amount is does not give you all the mercury that's coming off of these amalgams. The amalgam does not form an atomic bond with the tooth. I mean, there's a margin between the amalgam that you cannot see, that's under the bottom of the tooth. And when you put pressure on that amalgam, mercury goes out of the bottom into the dentine of the tooth and then the dentin tubules and ends up in the jawbone. If one goes and looks at the research done using radioactive mercury by the researchers at the University of Calgary in Canada, you'll see that the highest level of mercury was in the jawbones of those animals. And so I think that mercury would not be measured by a mercury vapor sniffer. So when you measure it and you see you're getting this so many micrograms off in the intraoral cavity, you're having as much, if not more, go down into the tooth and into the jawbone and into the rest of the body from that route. So I think that you can't absolutely determine how much mercury is coming off of an amalgam in the mouth, but you can, one, state it unequivocally that it is coming off, and that if you have this person chew gum, the level will go up dramatically, 6 to 10-fold. And then if you want to measure chemically, without a doubt, how much mercury is coming off, you can do it in a test tube. When you do that, there is no way that someone could, and you look at that data with pure science, with no estimations, you're measuring in absolute quantities, there's absolutely no doubt that mercury is coming off at significant levels from dental amalgams.
But then the supporters of mercury fillings will say, okay, so you have a little mercury coming off, big deal. There's no relationship to that mercury or vapor or mercury in the body to any disease, so there's no harm done.
Well, I mean, I disagree with him. You know, it's this old adage, you know, absence of proof isn't proof of absence. I mean, how many people smoked cigarettes for 30 years and said, hey, I'm a healthy, fine person, and then, you know, ended up with lung cancer? You have such a diverse genetic population that have amalgams, and it is a genetic susceptibility that really makes people, you know, respond negatively to mercury at a very early exposure time. So I don't think that you can possibly do this. What you can go back is say that there have been tests on animals that say mercury in water is acceptable only at this level. So then let's go back, drop an amalgam in a gallon of that water, and say how long does it take that amalgam to make that water toxic by EPA or OSHA standards? And you'll find out that's not a very long time at all. It's very difficult, you know, when you have people who smoke who are exposed to cadmium. I mean, they have a high cadmium toxicity level or level in their brain. Anyone, in our experiments, we have shown that if you add cadmium and mercury together, their toxicities are not 1 plus 1. I mean, the toxicity of the mercury and the toxicity of the cadmium, it's very synergistic. I mean, the presence of cadmium will greatly exacerbate the toxicity of the same amount of mercury. So a lot of it's your lifestyle. I mean, a person who is ill also presents a different problem. When you're very ill, you know, your energy levels drop down. It takes energy to make the molecule that binds mercury and removes it from our body, a molecule called glutathione. And we do know that when people are under oxidative stress from the flu or from a large number of illnesses, that the level of glutathione in their body drops. It also drops with aging. Older people have lower levels of glutathione. This is our protective, this is our defense against mercury toxicity. When the level of the protective compound is down, the glutathione levels, then it takes less mercury to get into that person and injure their nerve cells. And, you know, most people get amalgams when they're what, 15, 16?
Yeah, or younger based on how people are eating today. Talk about what mercury does. So we had, this is your background. You're the chairman of the Department of Chemistry, University of Kentucky. You're a professor. So you know, you have students, you teach them. Here's what mercury does in the body. We don't have the benefit of being in your classroom, but we have an opportunity for you to take us on that tour so we actually see what mercury is doing.
Well, what our research has established, and we did this about 8 or 9 years ago, we showed that the addition of very small amounts of mercury, not without a possibility of this being found in your brain, I mean, this is very realistic levels that you might be exposed to, interact with a very important brain protein called microtubulin, or tubulin. The tubulin holds the axons. I think most of your readers or listeners will know that a nerve has a long axon. You know, they extend it out. It has a very unusual cell shape. Tubulin is what holds the axon in its shape. Instantaneously, when you add mercury, within just a few seconds, it totally disrupts that tubulin structure, causing it to to fall off of the axon, and disrupt that structure, leaving a neural fibril out there that's naked. And this neural fibril can mix with other neural fibrils to cause neurofibrillary tangles, which is the diagnostic hallmark of the disease. And people have proven that experimentally. Also, if you take neuroblastoma cells in culture and treat them with 10 to the minus 9th molar mercury, which is much, much less than you find in the brains of people, you've got to understand some of it in the brains will be bound up with these protective compounds, but it is definitely within reason. When they did this, this work was done in Switzerland. When they did this, the first thing that happened was the levels of reduced glutathione in the nerve cells dropped to almost zero. And then subsequent to that, two biochemical events occurred, both that are considered hallmark or biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. The last one being the increased secretion of amyloid protein, which makes the beta amyloid plaques or the senile plaques that's used to diagnose Alzheimer's disease on pathological examination of the brain. So mercury, not only is it well known to be a neurotoxin for hundreds of years, yet also in my hands and in the hands of now other researchers, is mimicking the biochemical events that you see in Alzheimer's disease brain.
At what age?
You know, the age depends. That's an interesting thing that you bring that up. The age depends upon the genetic susceptibility of the patients. Now, there was from a Dr. Rose's lab at Johns Hopkins University, they found a genetic susceptibility, a gene that didn't cause Alzheimer's disease, but if you inherited the wrong body type, you were much more susceptible to AD. And this is called the APOE gene. And there's three gene types, and they're called 2, 3, and 4. And a patient or a person will inherit one copy from their mother and one from their father. And if you get two copies of E2, you'll never get Alzheimer's disease. I mean, you'll die of very old age. You'll be over 90 on the average from what they suggested before you would get it. If you get two copies of 3 or a copy of 2 and 3, you may be, in the 85. I can't remember all the exact years. But the bottom line is if you get two copies of 4 or a copy of 3 and 4, you're much more susceptible to getting Alzheimer's disease, before 65. And if you look at that protein, it's a protein that we call a housekeeping protein. It's made in the brain, and its job is to leave the brain and carry oxidized cholesterol into the cerebral spinal fluid, which bathes the brain, to be carried into the bloodstream and removed from the body. The one that protects you has two reactive thiols that can carry mercury out. The one that doesn't protect at all, or some people even say is causal for AD, has lost both of these two thiol groups that are in that protein structure. It carries cholesterol well enough, as well as the other one perhaps, or close to well enough, but it can't carry out mercury. And so you've lost the buffering capacity for mercury and mercury-type compounds and other oxidants that might, get into and affect the brain. And so I think this fits into the scheme that, genetic susceptibility plus exposure to a toxin is what you have to look for.
Now, we have two dynamics at work here. One is that the American Dental Association has suggested there is no association between silver mercury fillings and any conditions whatsoever. And another is the EPA and OSHA, who say even to handle, for dentists to handle mercury, they have to do so as a highly toxic environmental waste product. So I'm a little confused, and maybe someone else is. How can a dentist be told that you must dispose of that highly toxic waste product in a specific way or face fines, but I'm going to put it in your mouth for life with no consequence? Do you see the confusion here?
Absolutely. I mean, because I know a lot of chemistry and biochemistry doesn't make me any more or less confused with something as simple and straightforward as that you are. I mean, I'm confused too, and I find it... confusing to talk to anyone that would say that. Like, if you take that amalgam that you're placing in the mouth and drop it in a gallon of water in a few minutes, that water would be considered toxic by EPA. We tested the mercury level in the mouths of some of the students taking a class that I'm teaching using a vapor sniffer, the very same vapor sniffer that the OSHA group on campus used to say that we have to spend, a huge amount of money cleaning out the sink traps in the chemistry department to remove residual mercury that's been put in there, from 40 years of students doing experiments because we're getting too much water going out in the sewer, and it doesn't even come close to what we're finding in the student's mouth. It's a... what it does show you is that, you know, our government doesn't, agencies don't work very well together. And but if I had to come down on the side of anybody, I think the EPA and OSHA are correct and the ADA is wrong in this. And I don't like being labeled as anti-dentistry. I think we can just do dentistry better today without amalgams than with amalgams. And to say that, this is chimpanzee easy. I could train, a grade school kid to measure mercury coming off of a dental amalgam. And you can calculate the amount. It reads out directly on the meter. And if you can multiply and divide and add, you can say how much would come out of an amalgam. And it's not an acceptable amount by anybody's standards except the ADA. And what they want to do is they want to go back and say, well, a government committee said it was safe. Well, who was that government committee? It was a group of dentists. Dentists aren't trained in toxicology. They're not trained in OSHA or EPA to their standards even. And so, you know, if you say you can make a committee, I mean, that's an old trick to make a committee to agree with what you want them to agree with. The bottom line is go down to the science. Look, measure the amount of mercury that comes off of an amalgam filling made outside the mouth. And when you can control it and everything, and then see how much you can confirm that would fit with what you would expect to see in the mouth. And I don't think you'll find any dichotomy at all. I think you'll find that they're very toxic.
Are you familiar with Dr. Marshall Mandel?
I guess not.
Okay. I had an opportunity recently when I was a keynote speaker at a human rights conference in Florida, where jurists and activists and journalists and religious leaders from around the world met, about 500 of them. And after the talk, a man who I hadn't seen in years came over to me, Dr. Marshall Mandel. People in the audience, he's alive and well and living down in Tampa. And Dr. Mandel was a faculty member of the University of Bridgeport, University of Connecticut, I should say. He had three board certifications, one in immunology and one in pediatrics, and I believe the other was in internal medicine. Dr. Mandel had a unusual situation where a person asked to have their mercury filling taken out who had multiple sclerosis. And it was the daughter of a physician. And the physician had benefited from what is a simple, absolutely fundamental rotational diet, meaning for 5 days, foods that the doctor would normally eat, he did not. And he found that when he ate other foods and excluded foods he had commonly eaten, this elimination diet cleared up the pain of his arthritis. And when he added those foods he was used to back in, the pain came back. When he eliminated them, came back, they went away again. Well, this made at least a limited believer that there was a cause and effect, because he could turn on and off his own symptoms using himself and the foods as his own model. He had been a practicing physician for over 40 years. And of interest was he had a background in neurology. And his daughter had multiple sclerosis and had nothing had worked, and she was starting to go to advanced stages. And as you know, multiple sclerosis can take 20, 25 years to fully manifest in death. And a person can go through stages where they'll get worse. Then they stay worse, but they don't get worse. In other words, it's like they're in a holding pattern and a remission, but not a reversion. And then they go forward again. Her remission phases were very short and very few, and her progression was longer. He had heard through the work of a doctor, Hal Huggins. I'm sure you've heard of Hal Huggins.
Yes, I've heard of Hal.
Hal had evidently been on a television program, and he was watching it, and he just says, I have nothing to lose. So the doctor treating him and who had helped him with his rotational diet was Dr. Mandel, and he said, let's see what we can do for her. So they took out all of her mercury fillings, and immediately Dr. Mandel was challenged by the state for doing what was considered an unscientific procedure. It was going against the common medical practices in the state and their medical statutes in the state that if you're not using currently accepted scientific medicine than you're practicing quackery. And he said, no, I'm just removing those silver fillings and replacing them with porcelain. Person still has a filling. It's just a different type of filling. But that's still, they went after him. And they really put him through a process. It was at that stage that Dr. Mandel invited me up and to Norwalk. And he said, Gary, you know about nutrition. What I only know about elimination. I can get things out and test them. But what would be the best nutritional approach for a person who has a really virtually destroyed immune system? And so I gave a protocol. That protocol was implemented. And I got a call back, I guess it was a month or two later, from the girl herself, and she was just delighted. Her energy had returned, her clarity of thought had returned, because one of the problems when you have demyelinization of your central nervous system with multiple sclerosis is you start losing cognition. You're not always aware of where you're at, and you can't connect. You lose intellectual coupling where you can't connect concepts. Everything's kind of in the abstract. It's as, almost as if you're in a daze. You're in shock. You're not that kind of sensation where people are there. They're seeing and hearing. They just can't connect anything. And she says now she's able to connect things. She's got her feeling back. 6 months later, this woman came to a lecture I was giving in New York City with her mother and father. And she had sent me a little note up. And I invited her up on stage. And she walked up on stage, albeit with a cane, but she wasn't in her wheelchair. And she told her story. Now, what was also of interest is her mother suffered from a very debilitating gastrointestinal disturbance, and one that generally is not treated at all by an orthodox approach, and with a spastic colon, and you end up with nutritional deficiencies because your body quite simply isn't able to properly digest and absorb and utilize nutrients. And all that was gone when the mother was put on an elimination program and also had her mercury fillings removed. And what was of interest is, here's Marshall telling me, do you remember that? And I said, yes. He said, well, you know how many other women and men and children I took their mercury fillings out? He didn't, but he had other dentists take them out, but under his medical care. And he said, and they all had different improvements from different conditions that no one thought you could improve. From Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic disease, sclerosis, that there was an improvement and a slowing down of the progression, not always reversal, but at least slowing down. And he said, but nobody would pay attention, Gary. He said, is anyone out there listening? I said, some people are. He says, is there any improvement in getting that information out? I said, depends upon the medical boards and the dental societies. I said, it's more than just helping or hurting the patient. You got to understand something. In a highly litigious society where everyone wants to sue everyone else for anything they can, imagine the lawsuits that would follow if your dentist was shown to have used something in your mouth, mercury, that they should have known was dangerous. And they have to deny it. And if they have to deny it, then they have to challenge anyone who would suggest it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you pretty well painted a good picture for our individuals. But I would point out one thing that there is, with different people, definitely a connection. There has to be a connection between their diet and the amount of anaerobic infections they would have, say, in periodontal disease, and the illnesses that might be caused by mercury. In my lectures, what I talk about with students is, if you talk about people who have periodontal disease, they have a very aromic mouth. I mean, they have halitosis. The halitosis is caused by phial-related compounds, which we know what they are, and they are classified as neurotoxins. It's methyl thiol and hydrogen sulfide are the two that are best known. Those compounds, when they react with mercury, Those compounds, when they react with mercury coming off of amalgams, make methylthiomercury and dimethylthiomercury, and those two compounds are much more toxic than mercury by itself. So when you have infections that you're feeding by eating a diet high in sugars, and you're having a periodontal disease and you're releasing these volatile toxins, these toxins can react with the mercury in your mouth, making even more reactive compounds, more toxic compounds. And I think when we start looking, we're going to find more things that will support this high correlation between periodontal disease and the risk, as a risk factor for stroke, cardiovascular disease, low birth weight babies, etc., you know, generalized bacteremia. I have no doubt that, you know, there are many things that we can do that would decrease the level of exposure we have to toxins. One of those is to stop placing amalgams in the mouths of our children. And the other one would be to start looking at, you know, when were we feeding the human body and when are we feeding the pathogens that exist in our body?
Well, certainly N-acetylcysteine, glutathione, vitamin C, alpha-lipoic acid. These are nutrients that are known to have a very important effect on both chelating and building the immune system.
Yes.
Do you have others that you would recommend?
Well, the thing that's coming out that seems to be quite interesting right now is, you know, especially for older people, and that's the use of melatonin. Melatonin in scientific literature has been shown, you know, to increase the level of reduced glutathione inside both nerve cells and muscle cells. For example, in older men who are suffering from muscle wasting, I mean, their muscles are getting very skinny, they're losing muscle mass. If they put them on a melatonin treatment plan, and they biopsy the muscle tissue before and after they put them on melatonin, they see that the level of glutathione in their muscle cells go up, and they stop losing, and in some cases even start gaining muscle mass again. In this study that I told you about from Switzerland, if they pre-treated, and they had to pre-treat the nerve cells with melatonin, small amounts of melatonin, it's a hormone. If they pre-treated the nerve cells with a small amount of melatonin, they dramatically inhibited the effect of mercury to kill those cells or to cause, you know, aberrant effects in the nerve cells. So melatonin is something especially aged people should consider, and especially if they're having trouble sleeping. It's going to be something that's going to come out, I think, to be a major supplement for older people to take.
And it's so easy to get. It's inexpensive, and
yes,
it's
non-toxic. And you don't need much. You need less than a milligram a day.
Yeah.
And right before you go to sleep. I mean, taking more doesn't give you any more help. You get enough with one milligram or less. You don't have to take huge amounts of it.
Well, I certainly appreciate you being on today and sharing your insight. If people want more information, do you have a website or any additional literature?
It's a very scientific website, and you know, but it lists, you know, it shows our tests we have for, you know, detecting the severity of periodontal disease, the toxicity associated with it, and it also has about, you know, 400 articles on mercury toxicity that are, you know, out of refereed literature, and that number, that address is www.altcorp.com. That middle term is Affinity Labeling Technology, so ALT Corporation, CORP.com. And it's a very educational website, and you can pull up the references, you can read the abstracts, and if you want, order the paper from the...
Dr. Halley, we're out of time. Thank you very much for being on.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Boyd Halley, Chairman and Professor of the Department of Chemistry, University of Kentucky. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time today. So if you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346, Bergen number 2645. You all have a nice day. We'll see you back here tomorrow.